Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT. Bandwidth for Futures in Biotech is provided by CashFly at CashFly.com.
This is Futures in Biotech, episode 62. Blended rabbits, beard crystals, and protein crystallography.
I believe that biotech is the next frontier.
Probably the greatest intellectual revolution that's ever taken place in man's history. DNA is the code for life. We're actually beginning to understand how life works, which I think is something that's mind-blowing in and of itself.
There was going to be a genetic component to aging.
How long was there to the extension?
About 30-40% for humans. That would equate to something like 20 to 30 years.
How close are we to actually having a therapy?
Ballpark, 10 years.
So potentially one of the things that will end up rocking the world the same way that people said, oh, the sun is the center of the universe, oh, this and that and everything. And now here's somebody who can come out and say, hey, look, here's how we compare to our closest evolutionary relative.
Welcome to Futures in Biotech. I'm Mark Peltier. Today we have a show that was at the request of one of our listeners. It was Brad Eric Hollister that came up with the suggestion that we should do a breakdown of X-ray crystallography. So we thank Brad for this great idea. So when George and I discussed it, who should we have on to talk about X-ray crystallography, George had Alexander McPherson. He's the guy. He's the man. And today,
doubt about it.
Yeah, our guest is a professor in the Department of Molecular Biology and Biochemistry at the University of California, Irvine School of Biological Sciences. Dr. McPherson is also the author of about six books. I think it's six, and author of 300 papers or reviews. He's widely considered the nation's foremost authority in the field of macromolecular crystallography. For over a decade, he has served as principal instructor at the Cold Spring Harbor Laboratory, which is in Cold Spring Harbor on Long Island, in a course of macromolecular X-ray crystallography. Welcome to the show. Thanks for coming on.
Thank you very much. I'm pleased to be here.
By the way, while we're at it, I'll actually show the book. Here's the book. It's available on Amazon, Crystallization of Biological Macromolecules by Alexander McPherson. Is this one of your crystals?
Indeed it is. That's pig pancreatic alpha amylase. Unfortunately, that book's out of print, though, so you're going to have a devil of a time finding it, I think, except on Amazon.
Okay. Well, we could talk about perhaps which books we can get to cover this material at the end of the show. Because, you know, you just said this is pig pancreatic alpha amylase?
That's correct.
Wow. Oh, so that'll make sense to people at the end of the show.
What you're saying is it's pig spit, right?
No, it's the intestinal secretion of the pig. The pig spit actually has a different alpha amylase in it, but it's very similar. We can call it pig spit. It makes you feel better. Yeah.
And that voice you also heard is Dr. George Farr. He's a VP of Biochemistry and Biophysics at Aromics LLC, and he's going to help us out with the interview. He's one of the best crystallographer I know, so
right.
I thought I'd have him help out. So he might be able to translate some of the stuff you're saying to me, and then I'll translate it to my dad who's listening out in just north of Montreal.
Okay.
So how about we start with a little bit of history? Because, you know, X-ray crystallography has been going on for, what, 80, 90 years? Maybe 70 years? Maybe 50? And there's been major discoveries, right?
Absolutely. There's been major discoveries without question. X-ray crystallography has actually been practiced for about 90 years now. It was initially brought to us by the Braggs, Lawrence Bragg and William Bragg, back in the 1920s. It's only been applied to biological macromolecules, though, since about 1938. And it came into its own around 1960 with the award of Nobel Prizes to Max Perutz and John Kendrew, who were the first to actually determine the structure of a protein molecule or two protein molecules using X-ray crystallography. And it went through a slow period up through the 1960s and 70s, but in the 1980s, it's taken off, and it's just been an extraordinary tool for molecular biology for the last 20 to 30 years.
How about James Watson's work back? Was it in the 50s, where he solved the structure of DNA, 52?
That was James Watson and Francis Crick, and they published the structure of DNA, or a model for the structure of DNA in Nature, 1953. So they did that work across 1951, 1952. But those diffraction records that they used at that time, those were not really from crystals of a macromolecule. Those were from fibers, which are somewhat different, although they give diffraction patterns which contain similar information to those which we obtain from crystals.
And we should definitely point out that those diffraction patterns were collected by Rosalind Franklin.
Franklin, that's correct. And yeah. Maurice Wilkins was, she worked under Maurice Wilkins at King's College in London, England, yes. But I think now most people credit Rosalind Franklin with actually obtaining that crucial evidence that Watson and Crick used in to deduce their model.
So what I'm interested in is, before we get into how they threw an X-ray through a fiber and to solve the structure, is what is structural biology per se? Like, what kind of information or the data that you collect, how can you use it?
Well, the data is only indirectly related to the structure. What we mean by the structure of a molecule is we want to know the relative positions of all of the atoms which make up that molecule. Now, of course, if it's a very simple molecule of five or six atoms, that means specifying the X, Y, Z coordinates in some coordinate system of each of those five or six atoms. That's not such a difficult task. But in the case of a macromolecule like a protein, which may have a molecular weight of, say, 30,000 to 50,000 molecular weight, we're actually talking about thousands and thousands of atoms. And it's necessary to deduce from the X-ray diffraction patterns what the atomic positions, what the XYZ coordinates of every single atom in that molecule are. And we determine those not just roughly, but we determine those to a very, very high level of resolution. So something of the order of perhaps 1/10 to 2/10 of an angstrom resolution. So it's extremely accurate information that we get from X-ray diffraction.
But when Rosalind provided the structure, or not the structure, but the diffraction data, and then Watson went off to say, well, here's how the DNA is assembled. I mean, couldn't this information, I mean, it told them everything, right? They obviously saw the light. They saw Venus in the waves. It became...
No.
Isn't this true as when you see...
No, it isn't. It told them certain pieces of information. It didn't tell them at all the entire structure. What it told them was that it was a helix, and it told them something about the parameters of that helix, something about the numbers which define how that helix is designed. But they put that together with other information from other sources. For example, they had information from Chargaff, who demonstrated that the amount of thymidine was equal to the amount of adenosine, and which implied pairing between the A and the T. Chargaff showed that the amount of cytidine was equivalent to the amount of guanosine, which implied a pairing between the C and the G in the helix. So they had that information as well. They also had hydrogen bonding information as to how those bases paired within the helix. They had that information from yet other sources. So what Watson and Crick really did was they assembled a lot of crucial pieces of information and put them together in the right way to deduce a model for the DNA molecule. But they did not simply look at the diffraction patterns of Rosalind Franklin and from that immediately deduce their model. I think that's giving too much credit to the diffraction data in this case.
Sure. I guess what I find amazing when I look at the structures that are produced, they always hit the covers of the journals, is that there's a natural beauty to the atomic resolution structure of these proteins, and it seems that you can get so much information on how our biochemistry works from this, and that's critical to understanding the atomic resolution structure, isn't it? I mean, aren't we going towards a human anatomy down to the atomic level?
That's exactly what we're trying to do. We're trying to reduce the complexity of biological structure ultimately to the distribution of atoms in molecules and the interaction of the molecules that give rise to then organelles give rise to tissues, and the tissues then giving rise to the organism itself. We're trying to reduce everything down ultimately to structures that we can explain in terms of physics and chemistry. We're trying to, in terms of disease and medicine, for example, we're trying to reduce everything to a molecular level if we possibly can. And if we can understand things at the molecular level, then presumably we can build up from there and explain things which happen at higher levels, hormone imbalances, for example, or the development of tumors, or any of these other maladies that occur in medicine. So yes, that's exactly what we're trying to do. We're trying to explain everything really in molecular terms if we possibly can.
It'd be great when Google has a Google Human. Instead of Google Earth, it's Google Human, and you can, you know, fly your way into the human body down to the atomic level. That'll be a lot of fun. But man, those med students are going to suffer, right?
Yeah.
Anatomy is hard as it is, not to have to know where every atom goes.
Well, you know, it's very interesting, but you just mentioned anatomy. At one time, anatomy in the medical schools meant basically dissection of cadavers and taking animals apart to find out how the parts were strung together. Anatomy has moved now to the point where we're looking at molecules and we're trying to deduce from molecules how you get certain visible structures in the electron microscope and then in the light microscope. So anatomy, as you say, is reaching down to the molecular level. That's really what we mean by anatomy these days. That's what we mean by biological structure.
So there's no limit?
The limit, I think, is the atom. We're taking it down to where we see the atoms, and we can't go any further than that, certainly, but that's about as far as I think we need go.
So how about we break it down? How do you go about it? Like there's going to be a lot of parts where I just don't get it. And that's why there's a certain group of people that are called crystallographers. It's kind of like those who understand, C++. how do we tackle this? How do you start off explaining?
Would you like me to try to give you an analogy as to how X-ray diffraction works? Yeah,
Before it works, what kind of equipment? What kind of equipment do you need?
We used to use very complex equipment in which you beam electrons onto a metal surface, and the metal surface gives rise to X-rays, and you collimate those X-rays, and you direct those X-rays onto a crystal of the material that you're interested in, a protein crystal, for example. The protein crystal diffracts, produces a X-ray diffraction pattern, and that's recorded on something like a photographic plate. Now, that would be, say, what we did 40 years ago when I was a graduate student. That's the kind of experiment we would do. What we're doing nowadays is considerably more sophisticated than that. We go to national laboratories, such as at Stanford or at Argonne National Laboratories or at Brookhaven National Laboratories, and there we have these very, very large devices. Sometimes they're half a mile across in size, that are called storage rings or synchrotron facilities. And the synchrotron facilities produce very, very high intensity X-rays. So we go to these facilities with our crystals, and we place the crystals in front of these high intensity X-ray beams that are produced there. And again, we record the diffraction patterns. But nowadays, instead of recording the diffraction patterns on film as we would have 40 years ago, we have two-dimensional counters, or what we call CCD devices, which use charge-coupled devices in order to measure the X-rays. They're like today's cameras that we have in cell phones, for example, or any of the digital cameras that we use today, except that they're extremely high resolution so that they can resolve very, very complex diffraction patterns. Those diffraction patterns... Yes, go ahead.
So the Large Hadron Collider is also a source of X-rays?
It can be used as one, yeah. It can be used as one. That one is not being used as a source for X-rays. But there's about...
It's overkill?
Oh, yes. But there's many, many sources available now in the world. And even in the United States, I'd say there's probably a dozen very good sources. There's more than adequate, I think, X-ray sources available.
Oh, yeah, that's for sure. And, you know, it's really interesting when you go to some of these synchrotrons. I mean, it really is the area where physics meets biology.
Absolutely.
Because when you walk up to the front door as you go into what they call the experimental hall, and that's exactly what it's called. I mean, there's a little plaque above the door that says experimental hall. And you walk into this place and you can think of a circle that has a circumference of 1 mile. And the ceiling is, you know, easily 80, 90 feet above you to house this synchrotron where they have all these electron magnets set up trying to accelerate electrons around a vacuum tube that's got the total length of which is 1 mile. And it's amazing. It's big science. You know, you walk into these places and, you know, you're coming in with your little teeny tiny crystals and you want to study the structure of this small little protein, but you're using really big science to do it.
Yeah. Yeah, it's one of the most impressive things I think that you can do. And one of the most impressive things that science can show the public are these synchrotron facilities. The instruments that are arrayed around the circumference of these synchrotrons are absolutely amazing. They're many, many feet in length, and they're huge assemblies of complicated plumbing devices of all sorts, high vacuum devices, electronic devices. Everything that you can imagine that physicists could conceive of seem to be assembled into giant piles called instruments that are arrayed around these. And I have to admit, it's one of the most impressive sights for a scientist that I can think of.
I think I saw that equipment in a James Bond movie. Do they drive around in those little cars?
Actually, James Bond instruments are of low sophistication in comparison with the ones that you'll find at the synchrotron. I can assure you.
I think I remember the Terminator movie, Judgment Day or whatever, where they're trying to get out to fly away from this place where all this destruction is going on. And I remember they're in a synchrotron. Right? There's mm-hmm. a sort of a room that they're in where it's supposed to be some kind of a synchrotron, and the evil Terminator gets stuck to this electron magnet, right? And I remember looking at that, and I'm saying to myself, gosh, that's a really small synchrotron. I mean, it must be really tiny by comparison to what, you know, what we conventionally use for collecting diffraction patterns.
Yeah, that's true.
I have two questions now that have that come to mind.
Sure.
Why so big to look at the atomic resolution structure of a protein that's maybe 150 angstroms wide?
What's an angstrom?
What's an angstrom, and how small is that?
An angstrom is a tenth of a nanometer, and a nanometer is 10 to the minus 9 meters.
Right. So we're looking at like collagen, right? You know, or whatever, tubulin.
Collagen is large. Protein. Collagen is actually large on a molecular scale.
Yeah. To you, maybe. I see it as something very, very small. We're mentioning enormous amounts of power. Okay, mm-hmm. so the question still stands: why so much? So why such a big instrument? Two, why so much power? I mean, as a biologist who spent 3 weeks preparing this protein, I'm not taking it there because you're going to cook it.
And, oh yes, and,
I have no idea.
And go ahead. Well, how about those two questions first?
Okay, let me take the first one. Why does it have to be so large? It has to be so large because we're going to generate an extremely high intensity beam. So the size is necessary for the intensity that you're going to create. You can create an X-ray beam with a very small instrument, in fact, a tabletop instrument, but it won't have anywhere near the intensity that you will find at a synchrotron. So the size is essential for the intensity of that beam. And the fact that you produce a monochromatic beam, that is a very, very singular wavelength, can be obtained from a synchrotron, and that's very difficult to obtain from most other sources. So the size is necessary for that.
Electrons?
I'm sorry?
And electrons or X-rays?
X-rays.
George keeps saying electrons.
No, X-rays. Well, no, the electrons are necessary in order to produce the X-rays, because either the X-rays are produced by the electrons colliding with some target, or they are the X-rays are produced by bending the electrons or producing an acceleration of the electrons, and in which case they give rise to X-rays as photons. So in either case, yes, that you first must deal with electrons, but then that gives rise by manipulation to the X-rays.
So let's have a little bit of fun with the sci-fi. you've got a tube, right? And the tube, I don't remember exactly how big the tube is that houses the electrons that are being accelerated. I mean, maybe you can help me out with this one,
it's
Alex.
It's probably about 10 centimeters.
Yeah, about 10 centimeters in diameter. And inside of that tube, you create a vacuum, and you bring in some electrons that you use electron magnets to begin to accelerate around this ring that has a 1 mile circumference. And you basically coordinate a series of electromagnets going around that ring to draw the electrons around this very large ring close to the speed of light. And as they sort of bend their way around, they begin to emit these extraordinarily high intensity X-ray radiation. And then you shunt some of that X-ray radiation. You know, you open up a little window into this tube, and you let some of that X-ray radiation out, and you put it into a very large collimator that begins to sort of sort out the wavelengths, and you try to really bring it down to a single individual wavelength of light or of X-ray radiation that you then expose your crystal to. And it requires, because of, as Alex was saying, because of the incredible intensity of this X-ray radiation, it requires an awful lot of machinery to not only generate it, but to then collimate it, but also to protect all of the people that are using this X-ray radiation for their experiments.
Have you ever put your hand in the way?
No. Oh, no. Oh, no. You're not even allowed near the X-ray beam. In fact, the X-ray beam impacts your crystal is enclosed inside a shielded hutch, as we call it. It's like a little shack. Only it's a highly sophisticated shack, but it has an interlocked door with all kinds of safety devices. And if anyone were to even get near the X-ray beam, it would do terrible damage to them. So there's many, many safety precautions taken to ensure that the investigator never gets exposed to any X-rays. We all wear badges when we're at a synchrotron facility, and believe me, there are safety issues constantly that have to be addressed.
And it's pretty interesting in terms of safety. If you think about the amount of radiation that we're exposed to as X-ray crystallographers compared to, say, an airplane pilot or a stewardess in an airplane, they are, because they're at such a high elevation in the aircraft on a regular basis, they are exposed to an incredible amount of, you know, more radiation than we would be in these extremely safe, controlled environments at the synchrotron and other facilities.
Absolutely.
Well, we're looking at a photo right now of a synchrotron. That's pretty amazing.
There you go. Nice shot.
It's a big, giant circle with branches that break out of the circle.
And the branches that are breaking out of the circle are not to scale with that circle.
Okay.
Just so everybody knows real quick.
It sort of looks like a wagon wheel with the spokes on the outside.
I think at the APS, don't they have 100 or 200 of these types of little branches that come out?
I'm not really sure. I haven't used APS at Argonne Laboratories. I've used mostly the ones at the Lawrence Berkeley Laboratory in Berkeley, California, and the ones at Stanford, at the SLAC in Stanford. And there's nothing like 100 of them, but there's, I would say, at SLAC and at Stanford, for example, we're probably talking about 30 or 40 of them. Yeah.
Okay.
How do you measure the intensity of the beam? How do you know how strong it is? What is the unit?
Rentgens is the unit. Is the classical unit, but I'm not sure what radiation specialists use nowadays. But you can have detectors which will count individual photons, so that if you have a beam of X-rays, you can pretty readily determine exactly what the intensity of that X-ray beam is. That's not normally a problem. And when we collect X-ray diffraction data, and we look at an X-ray diffraction pattern, which is really scattered X-rays, we must determine very, very accurately what the intensity of those scattered rays are. And we can determine that intensity to something like 1 or 2% of the total value of the intensity. We can get very accurate measures.
Did you say it was megajoules?
Joules is a measure of energy. We're talking about number of photons, really.
Use photons as a number.
You could use photons ultimately as the number that you use. Yes.
What's the equivalent if you were to try to translate that in your head in terms of energy to something
like watts?
Right? Watts. Yeah. How many watts?
Oh, I have no idea.
It's pretty hot.
I have no idea.
Okay, so this is bringing me to the question. Here I've got my little protein crystal. Now we're going to explain or try to figure out what that little protein crystal is. Because I don't understand it really. And so you got this little bit of protein. It's like taking your tooth, right? And you've got your tooth up in front of this X-ray and it's a mile long, electrons accelerated to near the speed of light, and then you're cooking it. How come it doesn't explode? I mean,
how do you
not keep it from exploding?
You would have that problem. In fact, you do have that problem. The crystal does degrade rapidly in the X-ray beam. Now, what we commonly do is we take the crystals and we freeze them in liquid nitrogen so that they're cryogenic temperatures. And what we've found is that when the protein crystals are frozen at cryogenic temperatures, then, in fact, we can maintain them in the X-ray beam sometime for hours before they degrade so much that they're no longer useful for X-ray diffraction.
Cryogenic temperatures, is that like minus 180 or Celsius?
Minus 173 degrees centigrade.
Ah, I wasn't too far off. So you keep them really, really cold. And why X-rays? Why not infrared? Why not... Okay.
Because the X-rays we use have a wavelength of about one angstrom, all right? That's the wavelength. That's the what we would call the probe size, if you will. And the distance between the atoms in a molecule is about 1 to 2 angstroms. So whenever you do any diffraction experiment of any kind, you always must use a probe size or a wavelength, if that's your probe, that is of the order of the distances that you're trying to measure or the distance which separate the points that you're trying to observe. So if the atoms are separated by 1 to 2 angstroms, you want a wavelength which is about 1/2 angstroms or 1 angstrom or 2 angstroms. And that's exactly the wavelength of the X-rays that we use.
So Mark,
infrared has a much longer wavelength. Gamma radiation has a much shorter wavelength. Neither of those would be appropriate.
So, Mark, you can think of it a lot along the lines of the microscopy, which I know that you know very well. Your resolution is defined by the wavelength of light that you use.
Right.
Right? So what are the limits of resolution that you can get from a regular light microscope versus an electron microscope, for instance?
Right.
It's all being defined, as Alex was saying, by the probe. It's what wavelength of light are you using?
Yeah, I spent thousands of hours on an electron microscope because, light was just not small enough, which makes sense.
In theory, you can resolve 1/2 the wavelength. If whatever lambda is, your wavelength, in theory, you can resolve 1/2 of that distance or 1/2 of that spacing. Now, in practice, you can never get that close, but in theory, you can. With an electron microscope, it's 0.02 angstroms. So in theory, with electrons or an electron microscope, you could, in theory, get very, very high resolution of objects. But unfortunately, with electron microscopes, you also cook the sample as well. And so in general, you can't achieve that. Yeah.
Well, I've seen gold atoms.
Yes.
Just sitting in an array, which is pretty neat, using a 300 kilovolt. Was it 200? Sorry, it was a Techni 20, which is pretty neat. I was impressed. You can see atoms, but you're not getting the shape of the atom. That's a rat hole. That's what we call a rat hole. So tell us a little bit about protein crystals. How you've got this X-ray, and maybe you're even using really small X-rays, so you're getting really, really sharp resolution.
How about this, Mark? How about why a crystal?
Yeah, exactly.
Why does it have to be a crystal?
What is a crystal and why?
Okay.
Why?
Well, all right. In theory, you can get a diffraction pattern from a single molecule. I mean, there's nothing that prevents you, in theory, from directing X-rays onto a single molecule, a single protein molecule, and observing its diffraction pattern. The problem is that one molecule is simply not strong enough to scatter X-rays that we can observe. We cannot observe the scattering from a single molecule.
You also drop them on the floor often. They roll under the table.
And it's difficult to work with. Yeah, it's difficult to hold them in place. So what you have to do is you have to amplify the signal, which means that you have to use not one molecule, but a lot of molecules. But all the molecules, if you're going to get a consistent diffraction pattern, all the molecules have to have the same orientation when you direct the X-ray beam on them. All right? So if that's
why diffraction?
The case,
why not? Is it reflection? When you refer to diffraction, is it only diffraction?
You can think of it as reflection. We call them reflections. You can think of it as that. You can think of the atoms as reflecting the X-rays. That's not a bad way to think about it. That's basically what diffraction is. It's the combination of the reflections from all of the individual atoms.
Okay, so, please repeat that. This is for my dad. Combination of reflections?
It's you add together the reflected waves from all of the atoms which make up the object, and you have a diffraction reflection. That's exactly what you have there. Wow. So you direct the X-ray beam onto a set of atoms. Each of the atoms scatters the X-rays. The waves scattered by each of those atoms adds to every other wave, and the sum wave, the one that is the collection of all those waves, that's the diffraction spot that you observe.
So that one spot actually has information from all of the atoms.
That's absolutely correct. And that's a difficult concept, oddly enough, for most people to understand. But it's absolutely
It's sinking
true.
In slowly. Sorry, I'm sorry
it's
to interrupt. We're also
true.
On, we have a half Every, second delay here because okay. we're both going through Petaluma, California. You're in Buffalo, we're in Cleveland. And these electrons are going across the country and back. So, And I'm just sort of sinking this in. So the collection of reflections form a wave, and the sum of that wave is called the diffraction pattern.
That's right. That's basically
and
correct. Yeah.
Well, we didn't really get into the crystal.
Why do you need the crystal? Well, because as I say, you need to amplify that. You can't just take the atoms from a single molecule. That's not sufficient. You would never be able to measure the diffraction pattern from that single molecule. But if you have billions and billions of molecules, all of which are scattering exactly the same way, then you can measure the resultant from all of that collection of molecules and all of that collection of atoms. And that's what you have in a crystal. You can think of a crystal as a three-dimensional parking lot, if you will, where every single object in the parking lot, in that three-dimensional parking lot, has exactly the same orientation. So that if you beam X-rays onto that collection of automobiles, if you will, they will all scatter the X-rays in exactly the same way, and you'll be able to measure it. And that's exactly what the crystal provides. It provides that amplification of the diffraction pattern of a single molecule.
So it's sort of like having a whole bunch of white Toyota Corollas. I don't know why I picked a white Toyota Corolla. Maybe it's my dream car. Okay, you have a whole bunch of Teslas, red Roadster Teslas.
Now you're talking.
Okay,
right.
In a parking lot the size of Walt Disney. So you've got 10,000 of them. But
right.
So those are the individual proteins that are forming the crystal, and they're all parked in the same direction.
That's correct.
And then the parts that make up the car are the atoms.
That's right. You've
all
got
right.
it.
Tesla. All right. Okay, cool. So you're throwing a beam of X-rays through those cars, and because they're all positioned correctly, they're all going to reflect those repeat. There's going to be multiple repeats of each reflection.
That's correct.
Yep.
They're all going to do right. the same thing at the same time. And that means that they're all going to add together to give you one resounding signal that you can measure using the detectors that are available to us. That's correct.
How do you get such a beautiful array of Teslas? You know, what happens if you get a bunch, a mix, right? And some are Toyota, some are Teslas, some are...
Well,
that's the bottle.
That's the trick here. You have to grow the crystals before you can do the X-ray diffraction analysis. And before you can even grow the crystals, you have to purify the proteins so that you don't have a mixture of Toyotas and Hondas. You have only Toyotas. And that's another part of biochemistry, is the protein purification aspect of it. We have to carry that out first, get a purified protein. And then the second miracle we have to perform is to get all of those white Toyotas parked in exactly that same orientation inside of a crystal. And that's
right. With the Toyotas, point. Nobody cares about. People really want to know about the Teslas. So, so you want to go after a protein right. that's very exciting.
That's exactly right. Yeah. Yeah. Although it's interesting, it's just as difficult to solve a uninteresting protein as it is to solve an interesting protein frequently. But you're right. In general, what we are trying to do is solve the structures of those proteins that can really make an important contribution to our understanding of either molecular biology or some medical problem.
I'm going to show a picture here. by the way. I'm just going to show the cover of your book.
All right
here. So this is real. Let me see. This really is a photograph. What we're looking at, it looks like a big diamond, and you can see diamonds within the diamonds. Uh-huh. I've got a little reflection here. Okay, so it looks like a salt crystal or something out of Superman. You know, when he throws that crystal out into the snow and it forms this giant castle. So it's not this large. This isn't to scale here. What I'm looking at on the cover is a 4-inch crystal. I suppose the biggest ones you get are how big?
Well, the very largest ones we'll normally ever see are perhaps 2 millimeters on an edge. The ones that we can actually collect X-ray diffraction data from that are useful for the solution of protein structures now are of the order of 20 to 50 microns on an edge. And a micron is 10 to the minus 6 meters or 10 to the minus 3 millimeters. So we can actually nowadays collect X-ray diffraction data, which is useful for structure determination, from extraordinarily small crystals. Far smaller than we could ever have thought were possible 20 years ago.
Why I'm sitting all comfortably here. I forget I'm on video. So why do you want small crystals versus big crystals?
It's not that we want small crystals. It's just much easier to grow small crystals than it is big crystals. And in the past, in order to get the intensity that we needed to solve structures, we had to have fairly large crystals on the order of 0.5 millimeter, say, on a crystal edge. Now, because of these very, very high intensity sources that we have at synchrotrons and the very sensitive detectors that we have at synchrotrons, we can collect the X-ray diffraction data from these very, very small crystals, and still that's useful for structure solution. That's adequate for us to get the structure of the molecules.
So if I could interject for a second, I think, you know, when you're a guy at the bench in the lab and you've got your nice pure protein and you're trying to set up, you know, some crystal trays to grow the crystals, you're really and truly at the mercy of the protein.
Yes,
either it's going to do it or it isn't. And anything you can do to increase your chances of getting a crystal that's going to diffract well, you want to take it. So the notion of being able to use these really tiny crystals and be able to get good diffraction data from them is a major, you know, push forward in terms of our ability to solve structures of macromolecules in general.
Absolutely, yes. You have to understand the advancements in technology that have occurred over perhaps the last 35 years here. When I was a graduate student, it took roughly 1 year of time to collect the X-ray diffraction data, an entire three-dimensional diffraction data set from a particular kind of protein crystal. And in addition to that, it might have required as many as 30 to 60 different individual crystals in order to obtain that data.
Wow.
Now, we can take a crystal which is 1/100th that size, and we can collect the entire diffraction data in something of the order of 20 minutes. And it's far more accurate data than we could ever have gotten in the past. So the advancement in technology, the reason that X-ray crystallography has become such an important tool is because it's become so powerful, because of the combinations of technologies that have merged to give us, or I should say converged to give us this this amazing tool. In computing, in synchrotron technology, and in detector technology, what lags is the biochemistry. We're still using the same biochemistry that we did 40 years ago.
Well, sure. I would like to interject there, though.
That's a little bit of an exaggeration.
As a biochemist,
pretty darn close.
Well, we have genetics now, so we can make a cell line, a pichia, that is genetically has recombinant protein of our choice, and we can make grams of it, right? Versus 40 years ago, where you had to take the brain of a cow and then take another brain of a cow, throw it into a bathtub with a big blender and start and make a lysate. I mean, and then purify it based on its biochemical properties, its exact electrical properties. But now you take a Pichia pastoris or an insect cell line with a virus, baculovirus, and you can make so much pure protein and then attach a sticky piece to it to purify it. Right? That'll allow you just to separate that out. You can have the Pichia spit the protein out and all you've got is pure protein. Does that help?
No, you're absolutely correct. That was the other amazing advance that I think has propelled X-ray crystallography is that recombinant DNA technology that allows us to obtain very large amounts of proteins that otherwise would have been impossible from a natural source. And your description of putting the cow in the blender is not so far from reality. I used to put almost entire rabbits into blenders when I was isolating proteins from muscles. I never tried a cow, but I did do rabbits. And,
did you bother skinning them?
I did parts of cows.
What you described was not too far from the truth.
So we're kind of leading up to a part that I've been avoiding for my entire career, is understanding a little bit.
How do you get from a diffraction pattern to a three-dimensional?
I couldn't even ask the question.
That's why you got me here, Mark.
I could ask the question. I just didn't want to, you know, because that's the scary part. And I mean, perhaps
So you got the protein. We've concentrated the protein into a crystal. We've taken this crystal. We've put it up in the synchrotron. We put it in a little stream of nitrogen gas. That's
well, before you go, how did you concentrate it into a crystal?
Oh, back up.
Yeah. How did you do it?
A little bit of art and a little bit of science that emerged. But what one must do is to seek out and then optimize certain chemical conditions, which convinces the protein molecules that they should organize themselves into a crystal rather than be free in solution. And this is a difficult, often a difficult undertaking. With some proteins, it's straightforward, and we know enough different conditions which are likely to work that we can grow the crystals in a fairly straightforward manner. But frequently, the crux of the problem is to get the purified protein to organize itself into a crystalline lattice. And that's still what we would call the bottleneck in this entire process. And we're working very hard to overcome that, of course, but nonetheless, that remains.
Aren't there crystallographers, or is this an old lab tale, that never changed their shirt? And why would they do that? Is there, crystallographer in the red shirt, Mr. Red Shirt?
Yeah. I think that's a bit of an exaggeration. I mean, it's like the baseball players that don't shave until they lose a ball game. No, I don't think that most crystallographers are quite that superstitious. But
can I interject a little bit?
Sure.
Sorry. This is only because this is something that I do know about from, you know, studying chemistry a little bit. And you probably remember this as well. A lot of the organic chemists that came up in the 19th century had beards. And the theory is, the reason why they were such great organic chemists is one of the things that a organic chemist has to do is, once they've synthesized some small molecule, they need to crystallize it. And some of the best organic chemists back then, a little bit of dandruff from their beard tended to get into the beaker and mm-hmm. would form a nucleation site where the crystals would begin to grow. Mm-hmm. And that fact led a lot of, you know, to a lot of this lore comes from. It's not an issue of having, you know, a lucky shirt or a lucky sock or a lucky hat or something like that.
It's not the luck. It's the dirt in the luck.
It's the dirt.
It's the human factor.
Well, that's not totally far-fetched because, of course, we do know that most protein crystals nucleate on some particle or on some surface, and we've even seen examples, in fact, where protein crystals did nucleate on hair and on whiskers of various sorts from horses and humans and other animals. So it's not totally far-fetched that had some truth to it.
So has there ever been a situation where somebody couldn't get a crystal to grow because his sample was too clean?
I suppose that's possible. I don't think there's any documented examples of that. Yeah. My own feeling is the cleaner you can make everything, the better off you are and the more likely you are to get crystals. But it's possible that you can remove something which is essential to the crystallization in further purification. But I don't think there's any really documented examples of that.
Okay, let me ask you the ultimate question. Do you have a favorite place to crystallize your proteins?
You know what I do is I move my crystals around from one place to another because it doesn't matter what my favorite place is. It's their favorite place. And if you move around the laboratory, you find a lot of different temperatures. You find different vibration environments. You find, different kinds of influences on the crystallization samples. So what I do generally is I set up my crystals, and after a while, if I don't have any success, I move them to a different temperature, or I put them in a different part of the laboratory, and I move them around until maybe they find a happy spot. Gee, that sounds almost like suspicion, doesn't it?
Right. So it's one of those, it's like economics. So you take your drop of protein, it's concentrated protein, you lay that drop in an environment, in a chamber with various solutions, can differ, these solutions, with different pHs. And through evaporation, slow evaporation of the drop, it concentrates the protein down. Is that the only way to do it? Is that how it's done?
That's fundamentally what we do. But no, you can also crystallize it by changing the pH from a pH where the protein is very soluble to a pH where it's insoluble. You can alter the temperature. Some proteins are temperature sensitive. Their solubility is dependent on that. Generally, the protein solubility is very dependent on what other components are present in the solution. So as you change the salt or you change, for example, a polymer concentration like polyethylene glycol, or you change the concentration of some biological effector, any of those things can change the protein in such a way that it will be more likely to crystallize. And that's what you're trying to do. You're trying to find various ways to induce the protein to form interactions with other protein molecules and thereby form a crystal.
And they do this on the space shuttle? Or they did it on the space shuttle?
We did it on the space shuttle. Oh, yeah. We did many, many experiments on both the space shuttle and on the Russian space station Mir. And we did quite a number of experiments on the International Space Station before the Columbia disaster.
Why? How did it help?
Yes, it did in some cases. Not all cases, but in some cases, yes, it did. And the reason for that is you change the transport of the molecules to a growing crystal surface when you're in a microgravity environment. By eliminating convection, that means that the only way that a molecule can reach the surface of a growing crystal is by pure diffusion. And that's much, much slower process than what we call convective transport, which is, again, eliminated in space. And by changing the transport of the molecules to the crystal surface, we change the growth patterns, and often that change is a very positive change, and the crystals grow with a much higher degree of perfection, and in some cases, much larger as well.
Wow. I thought it's just simple gravity issue, and you wanted a round drop.
No. It's much more complicated than that. The control of the diffusion. That's right.
So you see how I've avoided the important question is, okay, now you've got the X-ray. We understand this source of small X-rays, why they're small and very powerful. Then you've got your protein crystal, which is a series of Teslas all parked in the same direction, built of subcellular or sub-Tesla parts or atoms. And then you're throwing that X-ray beam, and then you're looking at a sum of reflections of the X-rays, which forms the diffraction pattern. Right. How do you go from a diffraction pattern on film or on your CCD now to an atomic model?
Okay, let's say that you take that beam of X-rays that you're throwing at your Teslas, and let's say you move that around so that you're throwing it at the Teslas from hundreds and hundreds of different angles, all right? And that array of Teslas is going to reflect your X-rays depending on the direction from which you throw them. Now, if you go through many, many, many different directions from which you're throwing those X-rays, and you record each time how that assembly of automobiles reflects the X-rays in total for each direction, then there exists mathematical approaches to combining all of those individual observations, each one containing information about the structure of the Tesla. Each one of them containing a small bit of information. And the trick now is to combine all of those many reflections, all of those many observations into one final model for the structure that is responsible for those observations. And that is done by using something called a Fourier synthesis. It's a mathematical equation that does exactly that. It takes those reflected X-rays and it combines all of those observations, and from that gives you a model of the three-dimensional object which created that diffraction pattern. And I cannot really explain to you, I think, how the Fourier synthesis works exactly. That that was done, I think, in by Fourier. He was accused by his mathematical colleagues, by the way, of witchcraft because of the power of that.
I bet a lot of people I still accuse him of that.
But it was so the equation was so powerful, it was absolutely astonishing at the time because it was easily demonstrable that it, in fact it worked. And he was able to show them that it worked. And it works not just for X-rays, it works in fact for any wave phenomena. Be they electrons or be they light waves or anything else. And it allows you to combine many wave observations into a final sum. A microscope, a light microscope, performs a Fourier transform for you. A lens is a Fourier transform device, an analog Fourier transform device, in that it takes the scattered rays from an object, which you put in a light beam, and it recombines them into an image of the object. And you can magnify that image by using a lens system. So a lens is a perfect example of a Fourier transformer. The lens in your eye, for example, is a Fourier transformer. It accumulates the light waves scattered by objects in your field of view, and it recombines those by a Fourier transform process into the image which appears on your retina. And basically what we do in X-ray diffraction is we use a computer. We obtain the X-ray diffraction pattern, and we use a computer to focus it, to essentially focus that X-ray diffraction pattern back into an image of the object which created it.
Sort of like a mathematical equation that represents a lens.
It does
that
exactly
refocuses
what a
that
lens
scattered
does.
Set of reflections back into a focused image.
Exactly. Any physical phenomena can be explained in terms of mathematical equations. I mean, mathematical equations are simply short, concise explanations of physical phenomena. And the Fourier equation is a short, concise statement of what a lens does with the light rays or X-rays that impinge upon it. And we know what that equation is, and so we can program a computer to do that. And we feed into it the intensities which we find in our X-ray diffraction pattern, and it gives us out an image of the molecules that produce them.
Let me see. I've got my iPod Touch open right here, and I don't know if it's going to load up very quickly. I don't know which protein I've got here.
But if I can interject real
quick,
Mark.
Yeah.
And that Fourier equation is really pervasive through most of, you know, biophysical chemistry. I mean, it's a really key equation throughout. And I mean, it's used in NMR, it's used in X-ray, it's used in
mass spectrometry.
Mass spectroscopy for sure. And I think, you know, infrared spectroscopy, anything that involves the use of light, for instance, is going to use that Fourier transform. But all sorts of other things too. So
absolutely.
Mark's showing us a beautiful structure right there on his iPad.
We can't tell you what it is. We're not going to. But it's amazing. There's an app for that, basically. Well, this is not an app that has the mathematical equation to translate those reflections back into... I'm going to hit the circle.
Well, one of the interesting things about the Fourier transformation, Mark, is that you can take that structure that you're showing everybody and you can calculate back to a diffraction pattern.
That's exactly right, yes. That's the beauty of this whole thing. It's symmetrical. You can, given an object, you can calculate its diffraction pattern. Given its diffraction pattern, you can calculate the object. That's right. It's a totally symmetrical equation, and that's why it's really so powerful and so beautiful.
How did you do it back in 1975 versus today?
We did it exactly the same way. The mathematics are identical to what we used then. The mathematics were really worked out by the Braggs back in the 1920s. Oh, so yeah. The mathematics has been known, but what made the huge difference was the advent of the computers, the high-speed computers. We could never utilize that equation effectively except in very simple cases because the diffraction patterns were so complex otherwise. But with the advent of these high-speed computers, which has been an amazing revolution, just amazing, that's what's made it possible now to apply the same mathematical principles to protein molecules and to now deduce the structures of the protein molecules.
How robust are the applications that can take that diffraction data and translate it into a structure? I mean, I've sat in a room with last year's Nobel laureate, Stites, at Yale, and Vijay Pandey, who is our Folding at Home, the director of Folding at Home, and I sat and listened to argue almost ad nauseum for like half hour about the stats, right? And how that's not going to work, and this is going to work. Is there an app for that really, or at this moment, or does it really take a solid understanding of the Fourier transform of reciprocal space? Ready for mainstream?
It is raised. It is mainstream now. We have. I teach this course at Cold Spring Harbor every year, where we have 16 of the best students in the world come, and most of those students have, or in many cases at least, those students have already solved structures simply by using a series of programs. They collect the X-ray diffraction data and they run programs, and they don't even know what's in those programs or what those programs are doing. But those programs are carrying out the Fourier transformation. They're managing the data. They're scaling it. They're presenting it as a graphical image. In other words, this has been totally mainstreamed in terms of applications. And the programs are wonderful. I have to say, really very, very good programmers and mathematicians have built these programs, and they're extraordinarily powerful now. So you need not really understand the physics of the process anymore. I certainly don't suggest you ignore it and you not be aware of it. I think certainly you should, but it's not necessary, I have to admit.
Yeah, I think it would be better if people that were solving these structures did have a rudimentary understanding of a Fourier transform. But the question always comes up is, do they need to know what an eigenfunction is? And there are people in the community that say, you should know what an eigenfunction is.
Yeah.
And I must admit, when I hit eigenfunctions when I was an undergraduate, it was like hitting a brick wall.
I had the same experience.
It's amazing.
I had the same experience.
I have to, tip my hat to people like, Vladek Minor and Spicek Otwanowski and Paul Adams. And sure. Axel Brunger, guys who have made so many of these programs so accessible and so easy to use. It's just amazing.
It is amazing. Yeah. No, I think I spoke earlier. I mentioned the technologies, the high intensity sources, and the exquisite sensitivity of the detectors and recombinant DNA technology and the power of the hardware, the computing power. But the other thing that is frequently not given so much credit, but certainly deserves it, is the degree to which very, very skilled people have taken the fundamental mathematics and applied it to the problems in crystallography and just made what formerly were almost insoluble problems now almost routine. And that's been an extraordinary advancement as well.
For sure. It reminds me of this story that I was told by Paul Sigler. I don't know if you knew Paul. This guy was just an amazing scientist and an amazing man. And he would tell us this story about when he was working in Max Prutz's lab, when he was, essentially a postdoc back in, I guess it was in the late 60s, right?
That's correct.
Yeah. So he was there at the same time that Tom Stites was there.
Yes.
And if I remember correctly, the story goes that, once a week at lab meeting or something like that, Max would bring everybody's output from the computers. And this was back in a time when they had to submit their programs on punch cards. So they
That's
would
right.
have mm-hmm. multiple shoe boxes filled with individually punched cards. Mm-hmm. And they would submit this to the computer.
Mm-hmm.
And then the computer would, process the data and spit out a whole bunch of information for them. And when Max would present them with the information that they had hopefully gotten from this computer, you know, typically Tom Stites would get this big stack of paper. And that was, it was a great sign that, you know, the program had worked and everything went perfectly fine and he was going to have some real data to look at. And Paul would say, yeah. And every time I would get a single sheet and it would basically say to me that something had gone wrong with my program. And he told us that he spent the first, I don't know how long of a period of time, he would just kept getting a single sheet of paper and Tom would get a whole stack and he'd get a single sheet of paper. And then finally one day, he got a stack and he thought it was like the biggest thing and he ran out and celebrated immediately. But I mean, you know, go ahead.
Paul was a great biochemist, really. And that was his forte. Tom Stites was more of a computer jock. And that was, I think, why he got the stacks and Paul got the single sheets. But, you know, in the end, it was Paul's contribution that allowed them to solve the structure of chymotrypsin in David Blow's lab, which was a biochemical advancement that Paul made. So, they both made enormous contributions. I know both of them and knew Paul very well. Wonderful scientists, both of them.
Yeah. But a couple of your students have gone on to do great things.
they have indeed, yes.
So you have two students that went on to win the Nobel Prize?
No. We had two students in my Cold Spring Harbor course who went on to win Nobel Prizes.
That's what I mean.
Yeah. Oh, you meant it, Nicole. You meant my.
They learned
my
it from you.
Students. I had some pretty good graduate students too, but no. At Cold Spring Harbor, both Rod McClinton and Venki Ramakrishnan this year won Nobel Prizes. Venki was in the very first course we taught back in 1987, and Rod was in our course about 1994, 1995. And he knew nothing about X-ray crystallography when he began in that course. And we got him, I won't say we taught him everything he knows, but we certainly got him started on X-ray crystallography. And he went to Rockefeller and applied it to the ion channel and ultimately won the Nobel Prize with that. So actually, we're hopeful that some more of our students may end up there as well. We don't know. You never can predict.
You have about 8,000 to 10,000 listeners right now. So when this gets downloaded, perhaps there's a few out there that will take to heart the reflections or the reflect on the reflections.
Let's hope so.
So that's pretty good review, I suppose, of X-ray crystallography. I certainly learned a lot in terms of getting it straight in my head, which wasn't always obvious. I had an idea, but now I know that some of those ideas are correct and some of them aren't, but so I really appreciate you coming on. This is
a huge
honor for us to have you on the show.
Well, it was certainly a pleasure being on your show, and I enjoyed the conversation, by the way. I thought it was quite an interesting conversation, and I thought your questions were very perceptive, and I hope my answers were commensurate with your questions.
They were great. They were absolutely great. I think people can take it from this point on. Now they've got a basic understanding of X-ray crystallography. And, you know, there's 19,000 genes, right, in the human body? Is it 19,000? No, not 19,000 C. elegans. Sorry. The human body is what? 25?
It's 25 to 30,000.
25 to 30,000 proteins. Time to get out there and solve them all.
and solve how they interact with each other, right?
NIH has in a way embarked upon that project already.
Well, I brought George on here at Aromics to solve a structure of a protein, because once we have the structure of the protein, maybe we can get some compounds soaked into that and we can see how they interact, because we're looking for things that block the function of that protein, and the only way to do it is to really see it at the atomic level.
We envision doing a little bit of rational drug design.
That's wonderful.
And so, from this point on, I suppose the next step for students or for the listeners is to go to your library or go to the store or go to Amazon and get a copy of Crystallization of Biological Macromolecules or Introduction to Macromolecular Crystallography.
Right? That's the one. Get the intro. It's a great, great text.
Is that the one you recommend, Alex?
Yeah, those are fine books. I'm proud of those books. But I can also say that if your listeners would just simply go to Google and type protein crystallography tutorial, you'll find some very fine tutorials on the web, which explains many of these concepts probably better than I was able to today. And that information is all there, and I hope they take advantage of it.
Well, maybe we can get some Xbox 360s combined, some PlayStations to actually do those calculations. I think they'd make excellent rendering machines. Yeah. So again, that's crystallization of biological macromolecules, or Introduction to Macromolecular Crystallography by Alexander McPherson. And that's a really great start. I've got a copy here because George brought it. That's great. All right, so I'd like to thank you.
I'll thank
George, Vice President of Biochemistry and Biophysics at Aromics LLC. Thanks for coming on, and thanks for helping out with the interview.
Always a pleasure, Mark. Always.
And next, I'd like to thank Dr. Alexander McPherson, Professor of Molecular Biology and Biochemistry at UC Irving.
Irvine,
sorry. I'm French. Irving. Oh, well. Right, okay, so let me say that again. Edit, take on 3, 2. Professor of Molecular Biology and Biochemistry at UC Irvine.
Right.
Also like to thank the folks at Hauptmann Woodward Medical Research Institute in Buffalo, New York. We have Tara Ellis and George DeTida, who helped set up the recording. Thank you to them. I'd also like to thank Brad Eric Hollister for the great suggestion to do the show on crystallography. Keep those emails coming, and people can send emails to Futures in Biotech or mark@twit.tv, or just go to futuresinbiotech.com and leave a comment there, and we'll try and incorporate those ideas into future shows. I'd also like to thank Burke McQuinn for handling the audio and video boards today and the recording in Petaluma, California. Thanks, Burke. It was great. Great job on the switching, too, especially. I'd also like to thank our new producer, Tony Wang, for taking care of Fib from the Petaluma side. That was a great help this week. And I'd also like to thank the team that make this possible, Leo Laporte, Dean Golden, Eric Lanigan, Frederic Louis, and the rest of the team in Petaluma, California. Lastly, I'd like to thank Phil Peltier, Will Hall, for the opening and closing themes. For Futures in Biotech, I'm Mark Peltier.